Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, March 8th, 2018. I'd like to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down names, addresses, emails, web pages, phone numbers, whatever it takes to take action for the environment. Let's get started with announcements. The California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Sunday, March 11th, at 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. Linda writes, lately a feeling of spring has been in the air with warmer, sunny days in between chilly nights and early morning light. We will continue our broom bash efforts, removing non-native French broom. Do remember that daylight savings time goes into effect Sunday morning. We hope to see you at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. To get to Quail Hollow Ranch, take Graham Hill Road north from Santa Cruz. As you come down the hill into Felton, turn right at the light and drive 2 miles up East Zionity Road, and then turn left on Quail Hollow Road. A half a mile up on the right is the entrance to the park. They'll meet you in the gravel parking lot on the left side of the entrance road. Remember, that's this Sunday, March 11th, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. The California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Group is working to restore native habitats in parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Please wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. But if things get particularly unpleasant, they call it a day. It should be okay on Sunday. Remember to bring your gloves and your water. For more information, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. You can email her at redwoodrn, that's R-E-D-W-D-R-N, at pacbell.net, or visit the website at www.cruzcn.com. PS.org, that's CRUZCNPS.org. And there's a climbing camp March 26th through April 1st, brought on by the Cascadia Forest Defenders. They'll spend time learning to ascend and descend a static rope transverse between trees, use a crossbow to get into the tree, build and set platforms in a tree, build road blockades involving aerial structures, and much more. Once again, takes place March 26th through April 1st. You must RSVP to forestdefensenow at gmail.com. That's forestdefensenow at gmail.com. Or you could go to their website, www.forestdefensenow.com. And buffalo defenders have locked down at the capture facility in Yellowstone National Park to stop Yellowstone from slaughtering the last of the wild buffalo. An hour before sunlight on March 6, two members of Wild Buffalo Defense Collective named Cody and Crow descended from the hills into Yellowstone National Park's Stevens Creek Buffalo Trap and, using a steel pipe, locked themselves to the bars of the silencer, a hydraulic squeeze chute that holds buffalo for testing, shipping, and slaughter. In freezing temperatures, the individuals blocked the buffalo processing facility and prevented the park from shipping wild buffalo to slaughter. When asked why he was taking this action, Cody stated, I am standing with the Plains Indians as a member of the Ojibwe tribe in Minnesota, and I have a Blackfeet friend who helped me protect my territory from the Line 3 pipeline, and now I am here for him and the buffalo. I have a love for the people, that's why my mom passed down to me. I have the love for the environment and animals, and I feel like I have an obligation to protect them. If I have to put my body on the line to do it, so I will. The two Yellowstone buffalo herds are the last free-ranging, genetically pure plains buffalo in the United States. These buffalo are descendants of the 23 that survived the buffalo extermination campaign the U.S. government implemented in the 1800s to starve the Plains Indians into submission. Today, the Stevens Creek Buffalo Trap cost the Yellowstone Park Service $3 million per year to maintain, and despite years of public opposition, continue to operate their capture for slaughter facility within the park boundary. Activists and tribes allege that the Montana Cattle Lobby controls how the Park Service manages the wild buffalo. Crow, the other individual who locked himself to the facility, stated, "They can say they need to kill the animals to stop the spread of brucellosis, but wild elk have brucellosis and they are allowed to roam free because the cattle industry are not worried about elk competing for grass and the state receives income from elk hunting permits." By the way, Montana also sells buffalo hunting permits. Every year, the facility captures and sends roughly 1,000 animals of the 4,000 wild buffalo population to slaughter. While the two individuals locked themselves to the chute, some activists gathered at the gate of the facility with banners reading, "Wild buffalo slaughter equals cultural genocide." Their signs spoke to the connection between the culture of the Plains tribes and the wild buffalo, suggesting that by exterminating the last wild buffalo, Yellowstone is effectively attempting to do the same to the culture of the Plains tribes. The nonviolent direct action came in the wake of a decision by the Montana Department of Livestock and the Plant and Animal Health Inspection Service to deny the Fort Peck Indian Reservation the right to receive wild buffalo from the park. Wild Buffalo Defense needs your support. You can go to their webpage at wildbuffalodefense.org. And the Richardson Grove fight moves to court in this story by Tom Wheeler from the Environmental Protection Information Center. On Tuesday, EPIC and the allies were back in court to stop the highway expansion through the ancient redwoods of Richardson Grove State Park. Richardson Grove supporters packed the courtroom, an overflow-sized crowd that made the bailiff nervous and the judge pay attention. Thanks for all your help if you showed up. At issue was Caltrans' attempt to discharge the writ of mandamus issued by the Court of Appeals, a court order in non-legal aise, which ordered Caltrans to do a better job on analyzing the impacts on old-growth redwoods. By discharging the writ, Caltrans could be one step closer to starting their destructive project. Speaking on behalf of the trees, our hotshot attorneys Sharon Duggan and Stu Gross made clear that Caltrans' attempts to clarify the impact of old-growth redwoods just muddied the waters. For example, the number of old-growth trees impacted by the project has increased, despite Caltrans' assertions that they have shrunk the scale and impacts of the project. This failure to clarify the impacts is important because it violates what the agency was ordered to do by the Court of Appeals. Because the impacts to old growth are still unclear, although Caltrans does admit that a significant number of old growth redwoods experienced dieback in their canopy, EPIC argued that Caltrans failed to do what the Court of Appeals required of the agency. The judge, Honorable Keely Neal, was attentive and seemed to grasp the importance of the hearing. At the outset, she made clear that she would not rule immediately, as she would need time to consider the briefings and the arguments. "We are confident that the facts and law are on our side, but just in case we lose here, we have backup plans. If we lose at the Superior Court, we can always appeal to the Court of Appeals. Further, we have two new lawsuits, one filed in Humboldt County Superior Court and the other in the Northern District of California, that we will continue to press. We have held back the bulldozers and cement trucks for over 10 years. We aren't giving up the fight anytime soon." If you want more information, go to www.calwild.org. And the United States has lifted the ban on some elephant and lion trophies coming out of Africa in this story by Rachel Neuer of the New York Times. The United States has moved to allow hunters to import big game trophies, including elephant tusks and lion hides acquired in certain African countries, with approvals granted on an individual basis. The decision, reported in a memorandum published last week by the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service, overturns an Obama-era ban on some trophies and contradicts public statements by President Trump, who has endorsed the restrictions. In November, agency officials moved to lift the ban on elephant trophies from Zimbabwe and Zambia. The new policy supersedes and broadens that decision, officials said. Traditionally, the agency has considered imports of trophies from certain endangered species on a nation-by-nation basis. The Endangered Species Act stipulates that in order for such trophies to be approved, exporting countries must demonstrate that hunting enhances the survival of a particular species in the wild by reinvesting the money into conservation, for example, and by supporting local communities. In December, however, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit found that officials had implemented the Obama-era bans without following regulatory procedures, including a failure to open up the decision to public comment. To accommodate that court decision, officials said the Fish and Wildlife Service will change how it evaluates imports for certain endangered species across Africa, not just elephant trophies from Zimbabwe and Zambia, the subject of the circuit court ruling. Rather than evaluate lion, elephant, and bontebok, an antelope trophy, on a nation-by-nation basis, the agency will now consider imports of these animals from six African countries on a case-by-case basis, as it always does with the majority of species hunted on the African continent. The six countries are Zimbabwe, Zambia, Tanzania, South Africa, Botswana, and Namibia. The new policy does not mean that all trophies will be automatically permitted, officials said. The applicants will have to meet the same conservation and sustainability requirements as before. And there is no sign of newborn North Atlantic whales this breeding session in a story written by Karen Weintraub of the New York Times. The North Atlantic right whale is already one of the most endangered creatures on Earth, and all indications are its situation is rapidly getting worse. By last count, the entire population was estimated to include just 458 animals, and at least 17 of them have died last year. Now researchers tracking the right whale's normal calving grounds from Georgia to Florida said they have seen no signs of newborn whales yet this year, at a time when mothers would normally be birthing and nursing. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration estimates that at least 411 calves were born from 1990 to 2014, an average of about 17 a year. But only five were born last year, and if there are really no newborns this year, that would be unprecedented, said Charles Stormy Mayo, director of the Right Whale Ecology Program at the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown, Massachusetts. I think we're in a hell of a pickle, he said. It's possible, Dr. Mayo said, that the animals have simply moved elsewhere to give birth, and that at least a few new calves will be found later in the season. I will not be surprised, though. We'll be excited if we see a calf or two in Cape Cod Bay, said Dr. Mayo, whose research team tracks the animals in the bay. Researchers fly over Cape Cod Bay daily this time of year, following and counting the animals. So far, he said, they have seen an unusually large number of animals, including females of reproductive age, some of whom would typically be farther south with their newborn calves. The idea of so many of this extremely rare animal being in this tiny embayment is not comforting. Many should be elsewhere, he said. Whales are moving in unpredictable ways, Dr. Mayo said, because their food is being relocated by changes in ocean conditions. Unusually high numbers of right whales turned up in Canada's Gulf of St. Lawrence last summer, where, for instance, they were not expected. The last majority of animals known to have died were struck by ships or injured by lines set by fishermen who didn't expect to see them in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. They were not management controls because we didn't know they would be there, Dr. Mayo said. From 2010 to 2014, nearly six whales a year on average were killed or severely injured. According to NOAA, last year at least 17 were killed. Mayo thinks there have been more because those carcasses were never found, and they had sunk to the ocean floor. We're looking at the very real possibility of extinction, Dr. Mayo added. And guerrilla sanctuary workers in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo have been kidnapped by a militia in this story from the Agence France-Presse. 18 employees of a guerrilla sanctuary in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo have been abducted by a militia group, sources said. And officials with an NGO said the abduction took place on Monday in the area of Zavnu in Kahuzi Biega National Park. They said an armed group called the Mai Mai Rai Motumbuku was responsible. Abductees comprised nine administrative employees who were carrying out an inventory and nine guards, the source said. Koshampana Bielsale, administrator of the Sabunda territory, confirmed the news. 18 workers in the Kahuzi Biega National Park were kidnapped by militia, and Bielsale said the 18 are alive and talks are negotiating for their release, which will soon start as soon as a team from the park arrives in Sabunda. The abductors are demanding a large ransom, according to sources in local civil society groups. The park extends over 2,300 square miles of rainforest, more than twice the size of Luxembourg, and a largely mountainous terrain. The designated UNESCO heritage site is one of the last refuges of the endangered Eastland lowland gorilla, of which only about 250 now survive and is home to many other rare species. The park was established in 1970 by a Belgian conservationist, taking its name from two dormant volcanoes that lie within its boundaries. It adjoins one of the most troubled African regions, where armed conflicts have been ongoing for more than two decades. And animals are using Colorado's wildlife crossing and reducing collisions with vehicles in this story written by Shannon F. Hoffman of the Denver Post. Wildlife bridges and underpasses led to a dramatic decline in animal-related car crashes, according to Mark Loyler, a biologist for the Colorado Department of Transportation. The five underpasses and two overpasses that cross Colorado 9 south of Kremling have reduced wildlife-related crashes by almost 90%, Lisa Schwantes, communications manager for the Colorado Department of Transportation, said on Thursday. There are more than 30 passages which vary in construction across the state of Colorado. Only two of them cross over the highway. They're extremely important, Jeff Patterson, wildlife program manager for CDOT, said. When you get into conflicts with wildlife, that raises the issue. Statistics obtained by CDOT show that from 2006 to 2016 on US 160 in an area between Durango and Bayfield, there were 472 car-animal collisions, a large number of them involving mule deer. According to Lawler, the number could be higher, however, since vehicle-wildlife collisions are often underreported. An underpass crossing U.S. Highway 160 between Durango and Bayfield was completed in the fall of 2016 by CDOT. Photographs taken with a remote camera at the underpass show the passageway being used by deer, coyote, raccoon, and other small animals. At the Durango underpass, we're seeing a large number of mule deer going through the structure daily. Animals are using the structure. We're not just moving the problem, Lawler said. Colorado Department of Transportation has teamed up with the Colorado Parks and Wildlife to conduct a study identifying other key wildlife crossing spots throughout the state. We want to make sure that if we're going to do it, we're doing it right. That's why we just don't throw them in everywhere we can, Peterson said. Putting the correct crossing in the correct place for the species you want to get from one place to another, that's where it can get tricky. The crossings can cost anywhere from $300,000 up to more than $1 million. And Brazil's top court has approved a controversial forest law in this story from BBC News. Brazil's Supreme Court has upheld major changes to laws protecting the Amazon rainforest, delivering a blow to environmentalists. The revision of the 2012 law includes an amnesty program that scraps penalties for landowners who have cut down trees illegally in the past. Environmentalists say it will make the illegal deforestation of the world's largest rainforest acceptable. Farmers say the changes give producers confidence to grow the economy. The Amazon rainforest is the largest tropical rainforest in the world and home to plant and animal species that are still being discovered by scientists. Most of its million square kilometers are inside Brazil, where under laws dating back to 1965, landowners must keep a percentage of their terrain forested. That percentage ranges from 20% in some parts of the country to 80% in the Amazon, but the Supreme Court's decision eases that rule. The changes will reduce the amount of land that should be restored by 120,000 square miles, an area the size of Italy. It also provides an amnesty from fines owed for illegally clearing trees before July 2008, when larger landholders would have to replant most of the cleared land or preserve the same amount of land elsewhere. Environmentalists say the revised laws will reward those who have deforested in the past. Speaking to Reuters, Nirit Bensusan from the non-governmental organization Instituto Social y Ambiental said, "With this amnesty, you create a climate that invites deforestation in the future. It creates the impression that if you deforest today, tomorrow you are handed an amnesty." And Mountain Valley Pipeline has asked West Virginia judge to order protesters out of the trees along the pipeline route in the story from the Roanoke Times as found on the Earth First Newswire. Lawyers from the Mountain Valley Pipeline are asking a West Virginia judge to order the removal of protesters sitting in trees along the pipeline's route. The protesters' attempt to block tree cutting for the natural gas pipeline has no legal justification and could delay construction, the attorneys wrote in a motion for a temporary restraining order filed in Moreau County Circuit Court. Since February 26th, two self-described pipeline resistors have been sitting on wooden platforms in trees near the spot where the pipeline would cross the Appalachian Trail in the Jefferson National Forest just across the state line from Giles County. Unless stopped, the tree sit protest will prevent MVP from engaging in lawful construction activities, the motion stated. Mountain Valley contends the protesters are violating Forest Service rules. While it has received approval from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the U.S. Forest Service, and the Federal Bureau of Land Management for its 303-mile buried pipeline. A circuit judge has yet to enter an order or schedule a hearing since the request for a restraining order was filed last Friday. Named in the motion is Appalachians Against Pipelines, a group that has posted information about protests on its Facebook page, and Ashley Brown, who said during a cell phone interview with the Roanoke Times last week that she was one of two protesters about 60 feet above the ground sitting in trees. Five other protesters involved in a tree sit are not known to Mountain Valley and are identified in the court papers as John Doe's. In an earlier written statement and Facebook post, the protesters blamed greedy corporations for building a pipeline that will cause widespread environmental damage. From the beginning, MVP has tried to strong-arm people all along the route to get their way, the loosely organized group said in a second statement released after company filed its request for a restraining order. MVP issues letters and notices to intimidate and scare people. However, this notice tells us that MVP is scared. MVP is scared because they are learning that people are tired of their intimidation all across the region, the statement continued. We remain unwilling to stand down in the face of their destruction. And Latin American countries have signed a legally binding pact to protect land defenders in this story written by Arthur Nelson of The Guardian, as found in the Earth First Newswire. Officials from 24 Latin American Caribbean states have signed a legally binding environmental rights pact containing measures to protect land defenders almost 2 years to the day since environmental leader Berta Cáceres was killed in her home in Honduras. Last year, almost 200 nature protectors were killed across the world, 60% of them in Latin America. The new treaty obliges states to guarantee a safe and enabling government environment for persons, groups, and organizations that promote and defend human rights on environmental matters. It compels strong measures to protect national environmental defenders from threats or attacks and investigate and punish those whenever they occur. And it codifies the rights of environmental defenders to life, personal integrity, freedom of opinion and expression, peaceful assembly and association, and free movement. The 2016 killing of Cáceres, a winner of the Goldman Environmental Prize, focused attention on the killings of environmental and land rights activists in the region. Her death was one of 14 such deaths recorded in Honduras that year, in collaboration between The Guardian and NGO Global Witness, making the country one of the deadliest in the world for environmental activists. In a sign of progress, though, the number of killings fell in 2017, and 2 days before the new pact was agreed, Honduran authorities arrested a former military intelligence officer for masterminding Cáceres' killings. Costa Rica's president, Luis Guillermo Solís, described the treaty as a turning point in the fight against poverty, inequality, and hate. "It is also crucial for the very survival of our species," he said. "The right to a healthy environment is a human right." And Maules Creek land clearing continues despite lack of required offsets in this story from The Guardian, written by Michael Slezak. 5 years after the controversial Maules Creek coal mine in New South Wales in Australia was given critical approval to clear critically endangered native ecosystems, Whitehaven Coal has still not secured the biodiversity offsets demanded by the federal government, receiving a second extension in February. The delay has led opponents to call for offsets intended to make up for lost ecosystems to be established prior to the destruction taking place. This is a mine that was approved on the basis of the promises that were made by Whitehaven for the biological diversity offsets, said George Woods from Lock the Gate Alliance. The clearing that was supposed to have been compensated for happened 3 years ago. The community is still waiting for that to be delivered. Bulldozing has been going on for 3 years now, despite the offsets intended to protect the ecological communities not being secured. The Maules Creek coal mine was the subject of a 2-year blockade before its construction began, which saw hundreds of people arrested for protesting against the clearing of the remnant Laird State Forest. All up will involve the clearing of 544 acres of a forest type called box gum grassy woodland. It is listed as critically endangered under federal environmental law, with 95% of the woodland territory already lost in New South Wales. It is home to threatened species including the swift parrot, the regent honey eater, and Corbin's long-eared bat. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and www.freakradio.org. You can hear a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon, that is Friday at 3 p.m., as part of our Environment Friday programming. You could also listen to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 in the morning. You can listen in the future to KBOG 97.9 in Bandon, Oregon, Fridays at 10 a.m. when they get their streaming and transmitter online. KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m. WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill, Gilroy, California. KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California. KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California. And Berkeley Liberation Radio at 104.1 in Berkeley, California. All broadcast the Earth First Update. Check their websites for the day and time. You can listen online to the Grateful Dread Public Radio Podcast, GDPRRevolution.com. That address again, GDPRRevolution.com, Sundays at 2 a.m. Central Time. Or you can always listen to RadioForAll.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net, where you can go online, listen, and download this or any previous Earth First Update. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio, produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening. And please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.